From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta breaks down the complex energy bills that just cleared the Senate.
There are a lot of acronyms. If I fell into the jargon, you would probably think I was speaking a distant version of English or maybe even some foreign dialect.
A Syrian-born physician on traveling back to his war-torn homeland and his adopted home in Michigan.
Being in Michigan might be the best place for me and for my family. The acceptance for foreigners, the hospitality.
He was born in Detroit with drugs in his system. Today, he mentors young people to keep them from following his early path.
By the time I was 11 years old, I was cutting crack and on shoplifting excursions all across the country with my mother.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. For those who've been working towards a true regional transportation system for Southeast Michigan, it is back to the drawing board. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the Detroit Regional Chamber on what went wrong with the RTA millage. But first, in the crush of headlines last week about the presidential election, you may have missed some news out of Lansing. The state Senate passed a pair of bills that could add up to a dramatic overhaul of Michigan's energy policy. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here now, and these are pretty complicated bills, Rick, and they've been simmering away in the Senate for 2 years, so it's kind of easy to lose track of just what's in them.
Yeah, there's a lot in them, and it's very technical. In fact, there are a lot of acronyms. If I fell into the jargon, you would probably think I was speaking a distant version of English or maybe even some foreign dialect.
Well, break the bills down for us in broad strokes.
Well, what's going on? This is the first overhaul of Michigan's energy policy, the first major overhaul since 2008 and the Granholm administration. And what we're looking at is the big utilities are shutting down coal-fired power plants for reasons that are both environmental, they're old and they're polluting, and also economical, that natural gas in particular is a much more cost-friendly way of generating power these days. But the utilities are saying we've got to replace these plants, but before we replace these plants, we need to have some certainty about what our customer base is going to be, because it's not like the old days where just utilities staked out a particular area and that was theirs, and they put their rates before the Michigan Public Service Commission and they got approval or they got rejected. Now there's competition, a small amount of competition, but competition is still there, and they're saying that that leads to some uncertainty. So that was one of the things that the lawmakers who were working on this in the House and the Senate were trying to grapple with. Another one is the future of Michigan's energy policy when it comes to renewable energy. That last overhaul in the last decade set a standard of 10%. 10% of Michigan's electricity is supposed to be generated using renewable resources. And so environmental groups and some others are coming in and saying, well, we're about at that point, and so we should expand on that because renewable energy is the energy of the future. And so what happened was the Senate adopted this package, sent it over to the House, and now that's being debated.
And so first of all, back to how to ensure the certainty of the customer base. What does the bill do to accomplish that?
Well, the way that it works right now is that competitors can, in a region, poach as many as 10% of the customers from the utilities. And then if for some reason they can't provide the service at some point, then the customers go back to the utilities and they have to take them. The utilities are saying, well, that's not fair that you're asking us to invest millions, maybe even billions of dollars in building what are called these baseload power plants, which is just a industry jargon for very, very, very big, without guaranteeing us that we're going to have these customers. And so one of the things that that's in this package is that these competitor suppliers, they're not utilities in their own right generally, have to show 3 years out where they're going to be getting their power from and how much it's going to cost. And what they're saying is, well, the problem is that doesn't let us take advantage of the marketplace, because what they do is they buy electricity on the spot market and then ship it from wherever to their customers. And they say that's where the cost savings come in.
So they feel it kind of handcuffs them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so they say between that 3-year lookout, some of the fees for exiting and things like that, that as a practical matter, they're placing limitations on what's called the choice market that don't exist today. And another argument that's being made about that is also on the choice market side of it. Proponents are saying, well, you know what? This is an energy policy that's looking out 10, 20, even 50 years in the future, but that doesn't account into the amazing changes that we might see in technology when it comes to delivering energy. So are we going to lock ourselves into an energy future that requires us to use, say, natural gas when we might see some dramatic improvements in solar or wind or something that we haven't thought of yet? And, you know, that brings it back around to the utilities who are going, yeah, but we have to make an investment right now. And by the way, you're also relying on us to manage the grid, which is no small task.
There are a lot of movable pieces and players.
It can make your brain explode.
And then the renewable energy standard goes up by what?
The renewable energy standard in this package would go up to 15% by 2021. And the issue there is that some of the environmental groups say, yeah, but there are just too many off-ramps, too many excuses for not going there that are in it. And they'd like to see something that's a little bit more concrete in terms of setting this standard. And let's not forget, in terms of that also, what counts as renewable energy? Like some people have said, well, we have a problem with abandoned tires. Can we call those renewable energy if we burn those to create electricity? And the governor is very big on making efficiency part of the standard as well, because energy that you don't use is energy that you don't have to pay for and energy that won't be causing pollution.
Rick, any concern from the solar panel proponents with these bills?
Yeah, one of the things that is happening right now is that people who generate electricity on their own, whether it's through wind or solar, that they can basically load that back onto the grid and get reimbursed for that. The utilities are saying that, well, you know what? You're putting that back on the grid, but you, unlike us, are not helping us maintain the grid. You're not helping paying the costs of keeping that grid. And so they want to charge those small, you know, personal generators a fee for that. And they're saying that the people who use solar panels and create their own wind energy are saying, well, you know, that just takes away one more economic incentive for us to do our small part to try and be a little more renewable.
I want to talk about the politics around this. I hear that utilities are pushing to get this done in lame duck.
Mm-hmm. And this is considered a very utility-friendly package.
Okay. And they're worried that free market Republicans like Gary Glenn, who's going to be taking over as chair of the House Energy Policy Committee, just might do something to push it toward a more open market.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what we saw happen on the Senate vote is, in fact, just one Democrat voted against it, but there were seven Republicans who voted against it, basically over these objections about choice and the marketplace. And we seem to be having a similar debate shaping up on the House side with proponents of expanded choice, a more marketplace-oriented program, as opposed to the people who are saying, look, this is the Republicans. The Democrats are largely on board, but the Republicans who are saying, look, this is one of those areas where government regulation actually makes sense because it's so integral to the economic well-being and safety of the public that relies on a reliable source of electricity.
Rick, what happens if these do not get through the House and onto the governor's desk before the end of lame duck? Is it back to square one or does it hold over to be considered in the new year?
These bills would die at the end of the session. However, a lot of the main players will be sticking around in the new session that no one knew is coming into the state Senate on it. And the key players in the House are sticking around, not the Energy Committee Chair, Eric Nesbitt, but some of the other players. And so, yeah, it goes back to negotiating it to try and come up with something that gets enough votes to clear the House and the Senate and that's acceptable to Governor Snyder.
Is there any sense at all of how a Trump administration might affect this legislation?
We don't know yet for sure. He's said that he's going to end the, quote, war on coal. However, in many respects in Michigan, coal has already lost that war.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. As always, Rick, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Cindy.
There are some who consider this an unofficial state holiday. Today marks the start of firearm hunting season in Michigan, and tens of thousands of hunters hope to bag a deer. The Department of Natural Resources is hoping the successful ones will stop by one of their deer check stations before having their deer processed. It's a good way for the DNR to keep tabs on the health of Michigan's deer herds. Chad Fedewa is manning the Rose Lake Checkpoint Station near East Lansing. Chad, what happens at the check station?
So if a hunter brings in their deer to a check station, we'll collect some information from them. Mainly we want to know where the deer was harvested. We'll get information which county and township it's where they shot the deer. And we're also able to age the deer by looking at the teeth. We look at tooth replacement and tooth wear patterns to determine the age of the deer. And if it's a buck, we also take some antler measurements. We'll measure the beam diameters and count how many points.
Now, this isn't mandatory for hunters to do this, is it?
Correct. Most of the state, it is not. It's all voluntary. We do have a zone where we're monitoring for chronic wasting disease. There is 17 townships in that zone in Clinton, Ingham, and Shiawassee counties where it is mandatory.
Now, what's the mood like today? Well, hunters feeling happy?
Yeah, it's been pretty good so far. It's been steady all day. People are pretty excited. Obviously, the folks coming into the check station have been successful, so they're usually pretty upbeat.
Hey, is the warm autumn we've had, has it affected the deer population, or does it just keep hunters happy?
Yeah, so the warmer weather won't necessarily affect the deer population in general. It will make it more comfortable for hunters to sit out in the woods, but it also will require people to, get the deer to a processor or get it processed themselves more quickly than they would normally if it was cooler out. With these temperatures in the 50s and 60s, they'd be more likely to try to get it processed quickly.
You give the hunters anything for bringing their deer in?
We do. We give every hunter that brings in a deer a successful deer hunter patch, kind of a commemorative patch that people like to collect. We've been doing it since 1972.
Chad Fedewa with the Michigan DNR's Wildlife Division, busily working at the Rose Lake Checkpoint Station on this, the opening day of firearm hunting season in Michigan. Chad, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We see tragic images of the civil war in Syria in news reports nearly every day. Imagine watching those reports, knowing that's where you grew up, where you still have family and friends. Dr. Ala Abu Saif is a critical care physician who practices in Wayne County. He came to Michigan to further his medical training, and he now calls it home. But his Syrian roots are strong, as are his hopes for his native country. Doctor, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Let's start by finding out where you came from and what brought you to Michigan in 2010.
So I came from Syria. I live in a small town in the mountains, studied at Damascus University. Finished my medical school in 2006, started my internal medicine training in Damascus University, finished that, and came to Detroit in 2010.
And what was it that you were looking to get from coming to Michigan?
Coming to the U.S. was kind of an idea that built up during my training as an internal medicine doctor in Syria, just by seeing how well organized my attendings were in the university, teaching us internal medicine. There was a group of doctors coming. They were all board certified, American board certified, used to come do training sessions on biweekly basis. This guy was kind of an eye-opener for me and many of my colleagues of how medicine is practiced in the U.S. So we started pursuing this route of getting more training in the U.S.
And the Syria that you left, the home that you left in 2010, is nothing like what we see when we see the news at night, because the war hadn't broken out, had it?
That's true. It's nothing near what it is right now. Actually, I feel unlucky, but if you want to know what I mean, it might seem that I feel lucky. I left the country 8 months before the demonstrations in the streets started, and then followed by all the violence.
Mm-hmm. And give us just some idea of what it was like before the war, what the country was like, and especially where you grew up.
I grew up in a small village in the mountains, in a small city, southern Damascus, like 70 miles southern Damascus at the Jordanian borders. I'll give you a couple of examples about the Syria I know. Starting from elementary school, kids used to travel around the country in a specific month of the year, in April. Each year there will be one big city assigned to host all the kids from all over Syria who travel just by their teachers to stay for 1 week away from home, hosted by random people in their houses, doing activities during the morning time and getting more introduced to the family that hosts them in the evening time, spend 1 week and come back home. There was no fear, there was no hesitation in any family that I know sending their kids to such activities.
Which certainly would not be the case today.
Definitely not the case.
Even though here you are living in Michigan, but you recently went back to Syria, and I think a lot of us are surprised to know that that's even possible.
Yeah, they keep telling me you're crazy. I don't know if I agree on that. Again, I have to say that I live in an area in Syria where none of the violence happened. I go through checkpoints, of course, many of them, all government-controlled, and I reach my area safe. This is the third time I've been there in the last 3 years. The main reason I go is, as you know, both me and my wife have all our family in there. I want my kids to know the Syria I know and that the Syria I was raised in. And there's always hope for a better future.
You don't want them to think of Syria just as what we see on the nightly news.
You're right.
Now, recently, the leaders of the city of Waterford in Oakland County voted to stop being a part of the federal resettlement program for Syrian refugees until security concerns are addressed, or wanting more thorough background checks, or people talked about their worries about potential health issues and whether the community had the resources to support refugees. How do you, as you go through your work day to day, how do you address people's concerns about the refugees who want to come here from Syria?
If I want to put myself in Michigan people's shoes, it's an understandable concern. For me as a doctor, I would address it more from the health issues standpoint, more than the political or the security background standpoint. I would have to say that people's concerns from a background check is valid. When it comes to health issues, Syrians are not different than any other Middle Easterns or even North African refugees coming, or even visitors coming to this country. We have kind of protocols in the way we practice medicine in the U.S. to rule out some infections, but they don't carry a higher risk to the population more than any other visitor to the country from outside the U.S.
Knowing that you've been back to Syria, you've visited recently, and here you are living with, in a sense, one foot in Michigan and one foot in Syria because your heart is in both places. How does it feel to be in Michigan now?
Cannot be better for me as a person. I always say it. I came to Dearborn Heights, was my city where I first got into this country. I haven't moved around quite a bit. I live now in Livonia City, which is in the same county. Being in Michigan might be the best place for me and for my family to stay in the U.S. Generalizing may not be wise always, but I can tell you freely that the interaction I had with the Michigan people, the acceptance for foreigners, the hospitality I had in here from both Arab Americans, Americans, and even other communities in this state makes the variety here wonderful and makes you feel really home.
Do you think Syria will ever be healed? Could it ever become the country you knew when you were growing up?
It should. It should, and we should always hope. We have a responsibility of healing the wounds, especially those like me who weren't there when all this chaos happened. We have a responsibility of being well-educated, I still know people from all aspects in Syria, and I'm still having daily interaction with people from both extremes, if you want to say. It's our responsibility to heal the wounds and show people the path for the future. There should be a better future for this nation. We really don't deserve all what happened.
Dr. Ala Abu Saif, who is a critical care physician who practices in Wayne County, came here in 2010, came to Michigan from his homeland in Syria. Doctor, thank you so much for sharing your story and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Take fiddle and banjo tunes, Americana tunes, and mix them with the music and dance tunes of Sweden, traditional and contemporary. And there you have Primo and Gustafsson. Our Songs from Studio E series explores music combining both contemporary and traditional music from around the world. Laurel Primo is from the Upper Peninsula and a graduate of the University of Michigan School of Music, very well known in this state for her work in the American roots duo Red Tail Ring. She sings, plays the fiddle and banjo. Anna Gustafsson is from the Royal College of Music in Stockholm. She sings and plays the nickel harpa. We'll learn about that in just a moment. The two have been collaborating for the past couple of years, a transatlantic collaboration. And now they're out touring in this country to support their newly released debut album, I Walked Abroad. It is such a pleasure to welcome Primo and Gustafsson to Songs from Studio East. How do you describe the music, Anna, that you and Laurel are creating?
I think we have a core of this modal sound that is in both traditions. Also that it's often dance music, so it's quite lively and energetic and rhythmical. But also it's differences with the different rhythms and different scales. But I still feel that it has a core of something similar where we can meet musically.
And as we're about to hear, that is very, very true. How did you two find each other?
Well, 2 or 3 years ago, Anna reached out to me for another project. She was collecting some international women musicians for a grant she was writing. And that project didn't go through, but it allowed us the opportunity to meet each other just online. And I was just so excited by the idea to collaborate with Scandinavian music again. I wrote her back 6 months or a year later saying, let's do something anyways. And that's how it started. We started passing tunes back and forth right after that.
Now, when you say, again, working with Scandinavian music again, kind of remind us of some of the musical exploration you've done. I know you grew up in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, I feel grateful to have a little bit of experience with that before this collaboration. In the Upper Peninsula, there's so many Finnish and Swedish immigrants living there, second and third generation immigrants, and their music is predominantly the folk music that's played at community dances and things like that. So I grew up listening to that music as the normal fiddle tunes around me. And during college, I spent a little time in Finland just because I had learned, you know, I had a great desire to learn more about that Finnish music. So I studied some traditional Finnish fiddling over in Helsinki during my school years.
Well, it's time for us to listen to one of the tunes from the album. And this is a Swedish choral piece. So, Anna, you get to tell us the title and tell us what it's about.
The title is Lär mig du skog. And it's a choral, which is a religious hymn, and it's, well, the melody on this one is traditional, you don't know how old it is. Lyric was written in the 1800s, and it's about nature and to find inspiration in the different things in nature.
All right, let's take a listen. Mixing traditional and contemporary Americana and Swedish music, there's kind of a sense of a longing for home in the music and even in the way you're singing. Is that part of what underwrites that song?
Yeah, I would say it's about, it's interesting when you find a lyric that's written more than 100 years ago, but you still can interpret it today. Because especially the second verse in this song is about the birds and that you should be taught by the birds with their migration to break away and travel safely to unfamiliar shores. And this was kind of what happened also during the time the lyric was written, that a lot of Swedes were going overseas to America And they probably longed to their home, and it was not an easy journey to make. Mm-hmm. And also today we see the same thing with other shores and other people going the same direction. So I thought it was just, it felt suitable in today too.
Describe for us, and people will be able to go to MichiganRadio.org and click on the video of both of you playing, but describe your instrument, the nickel harpa.
Yeah, so it's it kind of works like a violin. It has four strings that I play on with a bow, and then it also has, a bit lower down, it's 12 resonant strings that are thinner. And these resonates when I play a note, they vibrate. So it kind of sounds like a church, like the reverb comes from those strings. And then I don't know what it looks like really.
It's got someone the keys that you're
yeah,
kind of playing with.
We call them keys. They're made of wood, and I press them, and they go to a thing that we call leave, that's also made of wood, and that presses the string. Mm. So instead of just putting the finger on the string like a violin, you press this key. And there's three rows of these keys to the different melody strings.
It's got a beautiful sound. How much do both of you want to dig back in time, exploring traditional music, versus maybe looking ahead, making new music, writing things that are brand new? What kind of...
Maybe equal parts. We featured a lot of traditional music in this record, partially because it was our first collaboration and we wanted some groundwork and, you know, teaching each other to become familiar with our work. But maybe about half of the pieces are new pieces. You know, some that use the forms of those traditional songs and some that don't completely. So I think we're equally excited about stretching in both of those directions.
Well, mm-hmm. Let's listen to another tune from Primo and Gustafson. This one is a very traditional American tune, and it goes back at least to a legendary 19th century fiddler from West Virginia. I kind of poked around on this, a fiddler named Jack McElwain. It's called Hannah at the Springhouse. When you think of collections of folk music, and there have been some very famous ones done, Lomax, and so many of these collections, we tend to see and hear men playing and singing more than women. And here you are as female musicians in 2016 wanting to leave your mark. But why is it, do you think, that we have this impression that it was more the men who were playing?
Well, I think it's like that with almost every subject. If you see history books or books of art, it's the same. It's usually men that had these jobs that to write the books or to collect the music mm-hmm. and go out and to record the musician. And they often chose to record men because they thought they were better or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of women playing, and also, in Sweden, we have a strong tradition of the herding music, which was almost only females, and that was a long time ago. But we kind of had this base of the music comes from that. But the only thing we see in the history books is maybe this mm-hmm. male mm-hmm. fiddlers.
What do you think we gain by keeping those traditional lyrics and traditional melodies alive?
Well, there's a certain power behind it being old, and certainly the songs that we're able to find now are the ones that kind of rose to the top. So they are the cream of the crop, the ones that have been orally passed down to us. So I don't know. It's just powerful to me to have roots in something.
And I think maybe with the lyrics and... That could teach us something both about how it was to live back then, but also mm-hmm. a lot of these songs has things we can learn from today too. So I think these tunes and songs are staying alive for a reason because mm-hmm. they're still played today. So
they're timeless.
Yeah, exactly.
The album is I Walked Abroad from Laurel Primo and Anna Gustafson, and you can find out more at their website, primogustafson.com. That's primogustafson.com. Congratulations on a beautiful album and making some beautiful music.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Voters in Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties last week rejected the regional transit millage, and it's 2 years before the RTA can try again. With us now is someone who is very hopeful that the RTA millage would pass. Sandy Barua is the president and the CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. Good to have you on Stateside, Sandy. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be back. Thanks so much.
The chamber was very, very visible in supporting the RTA. So from the chamber's point of view, why is public transit so important for Southeast Michigan?
Well, there's multiple reasons. You know, first of all, a robust economy requires, it demands that people have the ability to make money and spend money. And in order for that to happen, people need to get from point A to point B quickly and efficiently, using multiple modes of transportation. It just can't be one. And Southeast Michigan continues to lag in that. In fact, when we look at Southeast Michigan and the reasons why Southeast Michigan continues to lag our national competitors in terms of economic growth and job growth, transit becomes one of the key issues that is obvious is lacking.
I'm gathering that you really see this as something that the ripple effect spreads outside of Southeast Michigan and throughout the rest of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So, to put it in context, the world is moving towards urban centers. The rate of population growth in large urban centers across the planet is growing at an exponential rate. It started with revolution from the agricultural society to the industrial society. We kind of slacked off a little bit in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but now it's really back into moving to urban centers. So this whole idea of density in urban centers and allowing the people in dense urban areas to find that mobility access is absolutely critical. And as much as I am a huge supporter of the auto industry, I'm kind of a car geek myself, you know, what's happening is that people are seeing that the value proposition for owning a car if you live in a dense urban area really no longer pencils out anymore. And so millennials in particular have really kind of learned that lesson, and they're trying to figure out, okay, I want to move to places like Detroit, but I can't move there and bring my talent to a city like that, to work for companies like that, unless there's mobility options for me.
How much of a setback is this loss, Sandy?
Oh, it's a pretty significant setback. There's no doubt about it. We put our heart and soul into it. Major companies and people really stepped up tremendously to financially support this effort. And, I mean, these are private sector companies, all well-known companies that supported this. And, you know, they're obviously capitalistic. They have profit motives, and there was a reason why they felt this was so important. And obviously, we thought we had the best chance to win this. We've been working on this for 40 years in this region. We fell short, so we're going to have to look at different options going forward.
Why do you think it failed?
Well, there's several reasons. I don't want to pinpoint just one. I mean, certainly, it was a tax. Nobody likes, in the privacy of their voting booth, to vote for a tax. So that's number one. You always have to understand that when you're asking for a new tax in particular, that's a pretty high hurdle, to overcome. Also, there's no doubt that we got caught up in, the national election dynamics, Democratic, turnout, which primarily would have been a yes vote on RTA. Was severely depressed in places like Wayne County. There was just a definite lack of excitement at the top of the presidential ticket amongst a lot of the kind of the Democratic core base. I mean, it was about 60 or 70,000 fewer Democratic votes out of Wayne County in 2016 than for Barack Obama's reelection in 2012. But there was that was almost more than made up for by a pretty significant increase in turnout in places like Macomb County, kind of the home of the Reagan Democrats, where there's a very strong anti-tax sentiment. And, you know, while, it's kind of unfair to be overly journalistic about it, but, you know, Macomb County went very strongly for Donald Trump. Wayne County would have gone strongly for Hillary Clinton, but the Macomb County people showed up and the Wayne County people didn't.
In your view, how much of the rejection that happened on Election Day was about race?
None at all.
Why do you say that?
Well, so first of all, regional transit is as much, if not more, about suburban areas as it is about urban areas. And so I don't think the race issue has really anything to do with that. I really think the fundamentals of the issue were it was a tax, and people are very skeptical about any kind of government funding because their relationship with government right now is probably more strained than it has been in many, many, many generations, certainly in my lifetime. And I think you saw that play out with the Michigan vote regarding the presidential race, where Donald Trump pulled out a very unexpected victory in the state of Michigan. And I think all those dynamics played into the defeat of the RTA.
Sandy, you've got 2 years now before you get another crack at voters. So what can you do between now and then to lay the groundwork for a yes vote next time around?
Well, I'm going to defer those kinds of questions to the RTA itself. I mean, you know, the RTA board came up with this plan. We liked the plan. We thought it was a good, solid plan. We were happy to support it. And I don't know what they have kind of in store for a plan B. I know, and we know as a Detroit Regional Chamber, we need a robust public transit infrastructure. I don't automatically think that, well, the thing to do is to wait 2 years and go to the voters in exactly the same way we've gone before. I think we do need to respect the will of the voters. And learn from that experience and see if there are other ways that we can address this issue. But I think trying the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result, I think is the definition of insanity. So I'm going to let, you know, the RTA process work. They have a duly elected board. They have the transit experts on staff. I'm going to be anxious to hear from them as to what they think are paths forward. We're happy to input into that. Our political expertise onto that process.
Sandy Barua is the president and the CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. Sandy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for talking to me.
If anyone seemed destined to a life that would either end in a crime gone bad or in a prison cell, it would probably be Sean Blanchard. Everything in his life pointed him down that path, beginning with the fact that Sean was born with crack cocaine in his system. Instead, Sean Blanchard is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in math, and economics. He's attended Wayne State University's law school, and his memoir is titled, How About That for a Crack Baby? Sean Blanchard, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little about what life was like as you grew up on Detroit's West Side.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting because you grow up and all you know is what you know. We all have good examples or bad examples, and hopefully you may not know what to do, but you know exactly what not to do. So growing up, I was given to my grandparents, and so there was a male and a female in the household. They weren't the college type, worked in plants. And
we should say you were given to your grandparents because your parents just weren't able to do the job?
Well, you know what? So what happened was, so I was born with drugs in my system, and my mom, she's a professional shoplifter, and she didn't necessarily know what to do with kids. Her mother was raising the kids that she already had, and it was a matter of I was just a bit too much. And so my father, he was just kind of rolling stone, and he had his own family that he was cultivating at the time. So I was given to my grandparents. I mean, thank God for grandparents. Mm-hmm. You know, you grow up, and I had cousins that were more like my brothers and sisters, although I have 7 brothers and 5 sisters. Unfortunately, 3 of my brothers now are deceased, and 3 of them have served time in prison, and one of them is actually serving a life sentence and has 11 children.
So but the deck was stacked against you.
The deck was definitely stacked up. So even, you know, I had some brothers that would sell drugs, and they've been killed in drug transactions, and It's a matter of these are the people that you look up to. I mean, by the time I was 11 years old, I was cutting crack and on shoplifting excursions all across the country with my mother. And I felt the need to make sure that I can make ends meet and make money from doing illegal means and didn't see it as something that was bad. I can recall times, even in my book, where shoplifting just wasn't my thing. You know, this one time my mom, she bust my lip wide open because I didn't do the wrong thing right. And it was at that point that I just understood that I had to really begin to make my own rules in life because I didn't necessarily agree with the rules that everyone else had around me.
And you were seeing where it was leading them. And in, am I correct that your grandmother died when you were pretty young?
Yeah. See, my grandmother died when I was 12 years old. And when she died, I had no more rules any longer. So at that point, I had a roof over my head to stay with my grandfather, but he was like a roommate.
There was nobody pushing you to do well in school or follow rules.
How
does a kid from that kind of background, how did you wind up graduating from the University of Michigan?
My grandmother always told me I was smart, and so I believed it. And so by the time she left, being smart and doing good in school was something that Sean just did. It just so happens that, you know, I go to high school. I have a brother that gets shot. My father passes away. This is ninth grade. My other brother gets shot about 9 times and then goes to federal prison for about 4 years. And so I'm sitting there and I'm like, wow, grandma's gone. My brother's gone. My brother, who's a twin, is gone and his twin is gone. My mom is shoplifting somewhere. I guess I got to do what I got to do. So I began to raise my younger brother, who's 5 years younger than me. And I had to make the rules for him and I. And I've abided by my rules. And school was one of them. I didn't even have a destination, right? I just knew go to school. All the people I knew ended up in a plant somewhere.
Right. So where that was going to lead you, you didn't see that.
Who knows, right?
What was the difference? Who made the difference?
I had this woman. Her name was Miss Champion. One of the most beautiful women I've ever met in my life at that point. And she was a graduate of the University of Michigan.
And she was your high school counselor.
That's right. Yeah. She was my high school counselor. And she had just graduated. I would listen to whatever she told me to do. It was interesting because she didn't know the depths of what I was going through, but she knew some things were a bit off. And so I had someone once again now to show my report card because no one else was paying attention. And because of her, she's like, you know what? You're going to take the ACT. You're going to do this. You're going to be my Michigan man. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. I'm like, yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Whatever that means. I'm in.
Sure.
Yes.
Good. That's cool. And I had no clue what Michigan was. I didn't know this was some premier school. I didn't know what that was. I just knew the Fab Five was cool. Mm-hmm. Like the big basketball shorts. Chris Webber's from Detroit. That's all I know.
You're a kid. What do you know?
That's it. What do I know? But she actually set it up. I followed the rules. I got on the debate team like she told me. I was in compact like she told me. You know, I did some extracurricular activities outside of my extracurricular activities, which were selling drugs and doing all types of different scams. I would make sure I did what she said as well. And doing that, she had on-site admissions. The University of Michigan came to the school. And while everyone else was there with their parents, some type of guardian or someone else, I was there with Miss Champion.
And you got accepted on the spot.
On the spot.
Looking back, does it strike you what an amazing long shot that was?
You know, absolutely, because I didn't even write down a personal statement. I came in there. She told me the day of. She went and got my information. I had my transcripts. Mm-hmm. And they waited until I was last. Everyone else go ahead. Everybody get out of here. Mm-hmm. And Sean, they said, where's your personal statement? Let's have it. Yeah. And she said, you know what, Sean, just tell them your story. I told them where I was from, my makeup. I had a job at Red Lobster. I was raising my younger brother. I had about a 3.5. I was involved in school, doing this and doing that. And I know that if I had a shot at some school where I could be upwardly mobile and exposed to more than my immediate environment, then I would be able to make the world a better place beyond just my own life.
So you came to U of M, math major.
Mathematics and economics.
How was the transition for you, Sean?
You know what? It was interesting because I came into the Bridge program. Mm-hmm. I got all A's. And
we should tell everybody the Bridge program is.
That's right. The Summer Bridge program is a transition program from high school to college here at Michigan. I did very well there. And when I started in the fall, I just continued to do well. I mean, I was running laps around the grades, A's, B's. It wasn't difficult. It was just new. It was just the fact that, oh, no one else has ever challenged me like this before, but no problem.
Mm-hmm. But some of the old habits died a little hard, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Coming here, I actually, you know, they took the boy out of the hood, but they didn't take the hood out of the boy. So I came here and I was still selling weed. I was still doing scams. Mm-hmm. And I messed around my sophomore year, despite having about a 3.5 GPA here. I found myself in the county jail. Mm. I found myself on probation for the rest of my years here at the University of Michigan.
You had to have had a moment where you thought, oh, my gosh, I've blown it.
Oh, my gosh. Listen, when I went into the jail, I remember being in a holding cell. There was a guy who came in grunting, and he began to urinate. Mm-hmm. And it's an open field. You can just see somebody urinating, like, next to you. And so he's urinating in the toilet, and he begins to put his hands in it and swish it around in the piss. And begins to pat his head, and there's piss splashing. So we're like, oh, my God, watch the piss. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. And then another guy looks at me and says, ha-ha, first time, huh? And I said, ha-ha, last time. But I remember I looked up and I saw my face on a television screen. And it was at that moment that it was just shattered, you know. And I figured that I would get kicked out of Michigan. I saw my life flash before my eyes, and I figured that, you know, how could I go back to this prestigious university when they finally found me out?
But they let you back on probation.
You know what? The school never said anything, which is interesting. Actually, my professors were calling to bail me out. You know, I prayed and said the realest prayer I ever said to date at that point, and I vowed my life to make sure that young people would never be placed in that position that I was in ever again.
And I know from your book, How About That for Crack Baby, you have taken the mentoring that was given to you by Tanya Champion, your high school counselor, and you have mentored others. You've been paying it forward.
Absolutely. I mean, adopting youth, taking care of a lot of people, making sure that I could even take it a step further beyond the sheer motivation and conversation, but coming to my home, this is what you need. This is the path. And doing what she did by making sure that she can open the doors and pathways, introduce me to people to shake hands with that can be sponsors for me. That's what I do for people now. That's something that I live for.
Sean Blanchard, the memoir, How About That for a Crack Baby. Great talking with you, and congratulations on the book. And I know there's a lot of success ahead for you and mm-hmm. a lot of lives to change.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. It was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakla, and Nick Wallace. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.